Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon has called on the Federal Communications Commission to implement cybersecurity standards for U.S. wireless carriers rolling out 5G. The request comes as more experts in the tech community raise concerns over the vulnerability of 5G and its potential impact on human health. Joel Moskowitz is the director of the Center for Family and Community Health and the School of Public Health at the University of California, Berkeley. He recently wrote about the safety of 5G for Scientific American. We'll post a link to the article at WOSU.org/allsides. Welcome, Joel Moskowitz.
Good morning.
How does 5G work?
That's an excellent question. It works in a much more complicated way than its predecessors, 1G through 4G, in that it's implementing new technologies which involve an active antenna as opposed to a passive antenna. The active antenna uses technologies called massive MIMO or MIMO, multiple input or output. It also involves phased arrays, and it involves beamforming. It can essentially aim the signal at a particular user or set of users, whereas a passive antenna generally spreads the signal around in a fixed pattern. The 5G antennas can direct the signal because 5G actually involves lots of very tiny antennas that can then manipulate the signal and direct it at individuals.
Is it the ability to, is it that active antenna technology that concerns people about for as far as human health goes?
I think that's part of the concern. Another part of the concern is that 5G employs new wavelengths. While it also involves microwaves, low-band and mid-band microwaves, similar to what we've been currently using from 4G and its predecessors and Wi-Fi, it's also going to involve the use of millimeter waves, which have very short range and are basically line of sight in terms of how they can reach the receiver. So it's going to entail the deployment of roughly 800,000 or more new cell sites, cell antenna sites across the country over the next 5 years or so, which means many people will be faced having a cell antenna right outside their home, beaming directly into their home 24/7. And that has created a lot of concern among people throughout the country who have begun to organize and try to slow down or stop the deployment of 5G because they simply don't want cell antennas on their neighborhood.
Is there any research that shows that there is an impact?
Well, there's no research per se on 5G. In fact, there's very little research on 4G, even though that's been around for 10 years, because our government fails to fund the necessary research to adopt actual safety limits. The safety limits our government is relying upon were adopted in 1996 based upon research largely from the 1980s. And 90s or earlier, and were only designed to protect us from short-term heating risks as opposed to non-thermal risks or from low-intensity exposure to microwave radiation. And in the interim, we now have roughly 500 or more studies showing that low-intensity cell phone radiation can have adverse effects on our biology and on our health. So the government really needs to step up and fund the research necessary to develop effective safety limits.
Are you thinking that funding comes from something like the CDC or something like from the FCC? Where does it come from?
It's probably most likely institute to fund it would be the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, which is part of the National Institutes of Health.
Okay.
It's interesting you mentioned these other agencies. In fact, in the 1990s, the EPA was doing cutting-edge research on cell phone radiation, and when they found that there was evidence of genotoxicity from low-intensity cell phone radiation, the Congress cut off the funding of the EPA to do that research. And as a result, the EPA has not done any research on this issue since the 90s. The National Toxicology Program is the one major study that the NIH has conducted over the past two decades. And that study was finally completed a year ago. It was a $30 million study using rats and mice. And that study found clear evidence that long-term exposure to cell phone radiation caused cancer in male rats. It also found evidence that it caused DNA damage in male and female rats and male and female mice. And yet, this is probably the most exemplary study proving that cell phone radiation can cause cancer. And yet, the FDA summarily dismissed the study and said it's not relevant to humans. Which is ironic because the original regulations, the exposure limits that the government adopted were based upon essentially a rat study, and it wasn't even a change in biology or health of the rats. It was a behavioral change in the rats that the exposure limits were developed for. So our government is basically flying blind on this. Senator Richard Blumenthal recently actually used that phraseology in a hearing with the FCC, a Senate Commerce Committee hearing. That the government is flying blind on 5G, but I would extend that. We've been flying blind on 4G, 3G, and so forth.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking about the implementation of 5G, its vulnerability, and its potential impact on human health. My guest is Joel Moskowitz. He's the director of the Center for Family and Community Health in the School of Public Health at the University of California, Berkeley. If you have any questions, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. When you say genotoxicity, are you talking about genetics?
I'm basically talking about DNA breaks, single and double-strand DNA breaks affecting the genome, essentially. We have evidence from various studies showing effects on the neurologic system, how the brain operates, also evidence of reproductive harm and evidence of cancer in humans as well as in animal models. The human evidence is weaker because you can't experimentally manipulate treatments. Who gets exposed to cell phone radiation? Who doesn't? So the animal models provide much stronger evidence. But we do have human epidemiologic evidence indicating that long-term heavy cell phone use increases the risk of at least two types of brain tumors. There's some evidence indicating an increased risk of tumors of the major salivary gland and also the thyroid gland. Recently, the Chicago Tribune did an expose. They spent a year studying smartphones, and found that many of the smartphones they studied actually exceeded the very weak exposure limits that the FCC had set for cell phones when the phones were held near the body. This information has recently been replicated by a group of law firms that is currently suing the industry on the basis that the cell phone recommendations and the cell phones don't comply with the FCC limits. And yet the FCC limits are very lax in terms of protection. Furthermore, the public doesn't really realize this. Most of the public doesn't realize this, but when the cell phones are tested, they're never tested directly against the body. There's a separation distance ranging from 5 to 25 millimeters, typically. And the understanding was that the industry would let the public know that they should never keep the phones next to their body if they don't want to exceed the government's safety limit. In 2015, the city of Berkeley passed a law which requires cell phone retailers to post a notice about this information and also direct consumers to check the safety warnings in the cell phone manuals or in the cell phones themselves. And yet the industry is fighting this very fairly innocuous ordinance, which is just basically spreading information that the FCC had mandated that the industry pass on to the consumer. The FCC, the CTIA, which is the industry's lobbyist agency, has been fighting this now for 4 years, and they've recently reappealed it to the Supreme Court, complaining that this violates their First Amendment rights. So the industry really doesn't want the consumer to know that there is potential harm from cell phones, or even that they can exceed the safety limits that the government set up.
Is part of the problem that there's so many different regulatory agencies involved in this? You've got the EPA, you've got the FCC. You know, is that part of the problem, that there's no one agency that oversees the likes of a 5G, 4G, 3G, 1G, you know, network?
Well, there is one agency that is authorized to oversee and regulate this industry, which is the FCC.
Okay.
But the FCC doesn't have any health expertise, so they rely primarily on the FDA. The FDA doesn't have any funding to do research on this, so they rely on basically industry-funded scientists or the industry itself. And the FCC, which is in the Department of Commerce, is heavily influenced by the lobbying of the industry. Their primary mission is to promote the economy and promote the technology, not to protect the consumer's health. So they don't put much effort into the regulation of this technology. In fact, the Wall Street Journal several years ago reported that roughly 10% of the cell towers in the United States are not in compliance with FCC guidelines, but the FCC has no budget to regulate. So they basically respond to complaints. And when a senator, shortly after that, when a senator, I think about a year after that, when two members of Congress wrote the FCC and asked how many cell towers were marked as non-compliant in the past year, the FCC's response was one. And yet we're talking about many thousands of cell towers that are not in compliance with the very weak standards set by the FCC.
Are there any correlations with medical issues out there that I guess any kind of medical issues that correlate with the onset of the you know, 1 to 5Gs, 1 to 4Gs, I should say?
I'm not sure what you mean by correlate.
I mean, is there any concern out there that it's causing any kind of particular problems, or is it just not enough studies been done?
Well, there's concerns that it's causing it's contributing at least to a whole range of problems, because it can interact with chemical toxins. For example, very low-intensity exposure can open the blood-brain barrier, and if you have any chemical toxins in your circulatory system, they can then penetrate brain tissue and cause a variety of neurologic effects. It may be contributing to a variety of mental illness issues in our country. It may be contributing to a variety of cancers. There's most recently concern that thyroid cancer has been increasing rapidly and in the last decade, and that seems to coincide with the advent and of the smartphone, which has the key cell antennas in many cases in the lower part of the phone, whereas the early cell phones had the key antennas at the top of the phone, putting the brain at greatest risk of exposure. Many of the smartphones put the glands in the neck at the greatest risk of exposure. So this could well be contributing to thyroid gland cancer. And there is one study conducted and published by a group at Yale using data from the state of Connecticut that shows an association between cell phone use and thyroid cancer. There's also a number of people developing sensitivity to microwave radiation in general, or electromagnetic fields in general, actually, in some cases. And it's a range of nonspecific symptoms from headaches, migraines, skin conditions, ringing of the ears. There's a whole host of different responses that some individuals have when they're exposed to different forms of wireless radiation. It's called electrohypersensitivity. And this may be the most common problem currently, yet most people don't realize that their symptoms may be related to their exposures to electromagnetic fields.
You have an electromagnetic radiation safety website. What would people learn on that?
Well, on saferemr.com, I have much of the research on a variety of topics, ranging from AirPods to wristwatches to cell phones to Wi-Fi. And I've been disseminating many of the studies. In fact, in just the last 3 years, I have a one one document that now has over 800 abstracts on studies on electromagnetic fields for just the last 3 years. So the common perception is there hasn't been much research on this topic, which is true for the U.S., but worldwide the research has continued, and we have a substantial body of evidence indicating a variety of harms. In fact, the evidence for sperm damage is probably some of the strongest evidence that we have to date. So men should not keep cell phones near their genitals. There's also some evidence, although much weaker, suggesting that women who keep the cell phone in their bra are at greater risk of breast tumors. We need more research on this latter topic. But as I said earlier, our government is not funding it, and increasingly other governments have stopped funding this research as well.
Well, Joel Moskowitz, I thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Joel Moskowitz is the director of the Center for Family and Community Health in the School of Public Health at the University of California, Berkeley. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
StoryCorps shares unscripted conversations between two people about important things in life: love, loss, family, friendship. StoryCorps partnered with WOSU Public Media to record and share the stories of our city. Recorded here, StoryCorps Columbus preserves pieces of our shared history for future generations. Subscribe to the StoryCorps Columbus podcast now at wosu.org/StoryCorps, on the WOSU mobile app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. China has instituted an online video game curfew for minors, banning anyone younger than 18 from online play between 10 p.m. and 8 a.m. It's intended to thwart video game addiction, but the curfew is ordered amid increasing awareness of the impacts of gaming. And the problems are not confined to China. Anthony Bean is known as the video game doc. He's a licensed clinical psychologist, video game researcher, and author of the 2018 book, Working with Video Gamers and Games in Therapy, A Clinician's Guide. Welcome, Anthony Bean.
Well, thank you for having me.
What do you make of a curfew and what kind of impact that could have on this?
So I think that the curfew itself is in response to a lot of the different video gaming effects that are happening over in China and over in the other countries in that part of the world. So one of the things that we tend to see over in that area is a lot of our research over there suggests that there is a gaming problem, a problematic gaming. And with this curfew that's being placed in that capacity, we think that it actually will help reduce the type of gaming issues that we're having, but in past research that we've actually seen, it actually doesn't seem to work. It actually will have kids finding different ways to play the games or doing other activities that may not be as positively socially acceptable.
And is there any kind of rule of thumb at all yet about how much children, and I say children, this goes into the late teens, should be playing video games?
So it's an interesting topic. The AMA, American Medical Association, has suggested that no more than a certain amount of hours per day, but it varies, and they keep on switching their stance every 3 to 5 years or so. According to our research that we have seen out in the population, that there really isn't a good whole number that says, like, this is the limit. This is what you should be trying to make sure that your kids don't go over. This is what it should always have to be. When we work with kids over here, we tend to focus a little bit more on what is the maturity level of the child and how well developed actually are they, and can they handle this on their own.
And what is it that they're having to handle? Can we kind of talk about that? What is it that games do?
Absolutely. So games themselves are can be used in very amazing abilities to help us fight depression, anxiety, lower self-esteem, increase our life satisfaction if they're used accurately and well-trained by well-trained individuals. However, there is always a dark side, we would say, and we would probably call it more problematic gaming rather than gaming disorder, which is the World Health Organization is coming out with that later in the next year or so. And we would probably suggest that we would want to have a little bit more of a stronger boundaries. With every new technology that comes out, there's always a concern of what is it doing to us, how is it impacting us, and what is it going to do long term. This always comes into the parenting styles of creating what we would call that moral panic agenda and having an idea of how is affecting our society. And with time, that moral panic goes away. But the idea overall is just having appropriate boundaries based on the maturity level of the kid is what we're really focusing on. That seems to be super beneficial.
Does the kind of video game, the level of violence in the video game, the amount of sound, I mean, are all of these things part of the equation too?
So the research that we've seen from violent video games does not show a really good impact upon whether someone's going to become violent or anything along those lines. We have seen within video games that there is an increase of what we call aggression, but that increase only lasts about 5 minutes after exiting the video game. And aggression does not equate to violence or violent acts. So the concept of within that is we have to take each video game in as its own individual entity and work within that. So there's not necessarily to say that there's one video game that's going to be more impactful over another, because every video gamer is actually going to be drawn to different aspects of different games. So some will play more action games, some will play more adventure, some will play more simulation. The key is what is that draw to that specific game? Is it social? Is it exploration? Are they looking for something internally, interpsychically? That's really what we're focusing a little bit more heavier on, because we tend to see that when kids and adolescents play these games, the gaming actually is becoming a secondary condition to something more primary, such as depression or anxiety.
A secondary condition.
Yes. So when we work within the clinical realm, where there's usually see people can be diagnosed with what they call comorbid disorders, more than one, and they have an interconnectedness. And so when someone's diagnosed with depression, they start using coping skills in different areas of their lives. And a lot of the times that we have seen down here at the nonprofit that we run is that we have actually seen that the primary diagnosis is depression or anxiety or social traumatic disorder. A lot of those types of disorders are the primary one, which means that's the real focus we should be heading on, versus the secondary condition is their way of coping with it, such as playing video games or socially avoiding other individuals. And so if we hit the primary condition, then we tend to be able to reduce the secondary condition as well.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We are talking about video games and their impact on our psyche. My guest is Anthony Bean. He's a licensed clinical psychologist and video game researcher. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Game companies are making these games to make it so that the kids or anyone who's using them does not want to put them down, right? Isn't that their whole focus?
Well, their focus is to obviously sell the game, but it's not like they necessarily have psychologists going in and saying, like, oh, you need to do this because it's going to keep the person ingrained. We're actually starting to see a lot more in research that it's the narrative of the game and the competition of the game, those two avenues that seem to be a little bit more heavily focused on by the video game companies, because that's what gamers want right now. But a little while ago, 5-10 years ago, when we didn't have as much co-op online, or being able to play with other individuals, it was more action-adventure games. So the game systems and the games themselves shift over time. And just right now, this is just kind of what we're seeing overall.
Is the sign that someone's addicted meaning that they just can't give it up? They won't give it up? They'd rather – I mean, how do you know when someone is addicted?
So the ICD-11 disorder criteria is impaired control over gaming, increasing priority given to gaming over other activities to the extent that gaming takes precedence over other interests, and the continuation or escalation of gaming despite the occurrence of negative consequences. So when it starts impacting someone across different environments, such as school, such as family life, such as friend life, social life, that is when we want to start having a mental health professional kind of start looking at this and being like, what's actually kind of going on? Is there something going on in the family system? Is school really hard? Do you need psychological testing because maybe you have a learning disorder? There's a lot of different things that have to go into play when we are working with these kids, because if we don't use all of the information given to us, we then can sometimes misdiagnose the individual, which is one of the biggest concerns about this new gaming disorder criteria. We believe that they're probably going to lead to a lot of misdiagnosis.
And then the response would be inappropriate.
Correct. So let's say, for instance, when we treat depression or we treat anxiety, they have similarities, so we can hit them on similar cases, but overall there is different treatment plans to be able to help someone get out of bed versus someone calm down and be able to handle a social environment. They require different avenues of approaches. So if we are misdiagnosing and hitting the wrong avenues, then we really have a difficulty, and we're not going to be helping. We may actually be harming the individual.
A lot of times the violent games are kind of, we sort of default to that conversation about violent games, but they're not the only ones that are addictive, right?
Well, violent games themselves aren't necessarily the, and I'm going to reframe that into action games
okay.
themselves. There's a competition aspect within that. And so it's about the idea of being better than the person on the other side of the screen or being better than your best friend. So the competition is just kind of moved into the esports arena a little bit. Same thing as like playing against someone in a soccer team or a football team. It becomes a little bit more solidarity than overall teamwork.
And all right, so are non-action games, I guess you talked about like role-playing games, that kind of a thing, adventure games, are those less addictive?
Well, we would probably say that we tend to see a lot of individuals having less problems stopping playing those games, but it also depends if, like, the role-playing game, the MMOs, we would say that those have a social aspect to them, that if someone's having difficulties in their high school with social cliques and they're being bullied, they may go to the online realm to feel connected to a guild, to feel connected to meaning because they take down a big boss with their team. And those social friends become real friends to them and someone that they can rely on. So there's different aspects that we have to be aware of within the culture of video gaming overall.
How do parents start to address this? They're not experts, and there are not a lot of you out there, Anthony Bean.
There are not, but we are growing. There's definitely a lot of people that are coming to terms with the idea that video games and other gaming aspects can be used to help bolster a lot of our own mental health abilities. And so when parents are having concerns, they should really meet with a mental health expert, someone who understands the video game realm, if they can find one, or someone that has been well-versed within the culture itself. And that helps create those boundaries and those different avenues of success for the individual and the family structure, because it's not just necessarily about working solely with that individual, but the family as a system as well. That's super important to take into consideration.
When do you think children should be allowed to start playing video games?
That's a great question. I think that's more of a family decision, because we have met people who allow their 2 to 3 year olds to play educational games such as Elmo mm-hmm. on the iPhone versus other parents want them to wait until they're 8 to 9. So it really kind of depends, but we have Leapsters, we have learning pads, and we have all sorts of other stuff that are out there in a video game format that mm-hmm. can be educational.
And what about the relationship or like parents playing games with their kids? Is that of value?
It's one of the biggest things that we encourage is to have the parents play the games with the kids, because it helps them understand what the culture is. It helps the kid teach the parents something new, and it really focuses on building up that family structure for them. So it in a nutshell, it's really one of the main interventions that we focus in on when we work with parents.
So you're kind of seeing video games then from a couple different, from many different perspectives. They can be helpful too.
Yes, we believe that they can be helpful if they're used accurately. So it's the same thing as overeating or exercising too much or maybe going and playing a sport too heavily. I mean, within moderation, everything can be used adequately in a pro-social environment.
Hmm. Well, there's not enough time to finish the conversation. This could go on for a long time. But Anthony Bean, I thank you for your time today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on.
Anthony Bean is a licensed clinical psychologist and video game researcher. He's known as the Video Game Doc. His book, 2018 book, is titled Working with Video Gamers and Games in Therapy, A Clinician's Guide. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. The new Disney Plus streaming service is finally here. Both critics and consumers have given the service high marks. Russell Holley is a contributing editor at Android Central. He joins us as well. Welcome, Russell.
Thank you.
All right. So what do you think of Disney Plus so far?
So far, it's delivered exactly what I thought it was going to, and actually a little bit more. We actually there was an announcement very late last night where the entirety of the Star Wars Cinematic Collection was being released in 4K with HDR capabilities, which means if you have a really high-end television, you're going to get kind of a unique experience in watching some of the Star Wars movies that you know you otherwise would have need to go and see in a theater in order to fully appreciate.
Wow. Just saying Star Wars alone, you got me. It sounds, so Star Wars and what other kind of content? Is it just the whole universe? Can I see Pollyanna too?
This is pretty much the entire Disney catalog, which you have to remember now includes the entire Marvel Cinematic Universe and Fox and Star Wars. So it's just this massive collection of things that goes back decades. You know, every television show that was on, you know, Disney when people like me were growing up, you know, the you know, series of you know, Disney original movies,
the Wonderful World of Disney.
Yeah, basically, yeah, all of those, you know, all of those movies going back so many years, those are all available here, including a bunch of new stuff. There's a live action version of Lady and the Tramp, which is available exclusively on Disney Plus right now. There's just a ton of stuff. Star Wars, The Mandalorian just came out as well, and a lot of different TV series that are kind of unique and new to the service. It's really great to have, you know, this massive collection. It's also worth pointing out that it's a little unstable right now. There are some people who are finding that after creating an account today and logging in that they're getting a warning that says that the service is kind of having trouble keeping up with everyone right now. Which is kind of a standard day one thing. There's just so many people trying to use the service right now that it's the Disney service is trying to keep up. And it's something that Disney has already addressed and will likely have completely figured out by the end of the day. But it's just, you know, there's just this incredible demand for it. There are so many people signing up for it and using it right now that it's kind of unsurprising.
And the pricing and everything, how's that working?
You're starting off with $8 a month for access to the entire thing, and this is a family account, so you can actually share it with multiple people and multiple televisions. It also works on just about everything that streams things, from, you know, Samsung smart televisions to your phone and your tablet to, you know, Rokus and Chromecast and things like that. Curiously, if you have an iPhone or an Apple TV, it's actually a little hard to find the Disney Plus app right now. You can't just search Disney Plus and have it be the first thing that shows up in the App Store. You kind of have to dig around for it a little bit to find it. But it is there. There is an iPhone Disney Plus app and an Apple TV Disney Plus app. It's just not as immediately available as it probably should be, which I'm sure definitely totally doesn't have anything to do with Apple TV Plus having just recently come out.
Right.
But, you know. It's a little difficult to find if you have one of those things, but it is still there, and it's on basically everything right now, and is just ready to go for the most part.
What kind of impact do you think this is going to have on the streaming industry in general?
I think this is going to have a pretty significant impact on the streaming industry. I think Netflix has, you know, its first real long-term competitor here, and the reason that I say that is, you know, Netflix does a really good job appealing to a bunch of smaller audiences, whereas Disney Plus is able to appeal to the biggest audience. You know, you have to keep in mind that something like 7 of the 10 highest-grossing films of all time are Disney properties now. You know, and that's not nothing. When you combine that with things that people are going to just watch over and over and over again, it's really kind of impressive how much content is in this one place. At the same time, Netflix has in particular adult comedies and documentaries and things like that that are never going to be the kind of thing you're going to see on Disney Plus. So the real concern, I think, for most of the other streaming services that aren't Disney Plus and Netflix is whether a person who is buying these streaming services feels like it is worth having a third service. You know, because I think a lot of people for at least the immediate future are going to consider having Disney Plus and Netflix and not have to worry about choosing between them right now.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to also adding in HBO or also adding in, Amazon Prime Video or also adding in, Verve or something like that, that becomes a lot more challenging to justify that kind of third expense at that point.
Is this the kind of service, though, that you can just let the kids have at and you don't have to worry about anything in terms of content?
For the most part, I would absolutely say so. I mean, there are tools in here that you can restrict for content if you don't want to, if you only want them to have access to, G-rated content or PG-rated content, you have that limiter, which is the same thing that exists in most places.
Right.
But if it's, it's Disney content. There is no real adult content here. Like, you're not going to find anything that's any more graphically violent than you would find in your average Marvel film. And so that, if you are comfortable with your kids watching Avengers Endgame, then everything that's on here is going to be appropriate for them.
Okay. We shall see. Let's talk about virtual reality. Now they're using it in hospitals for pain management in children.
Yeah, this is actually really fascinating. There's been a lot of work over the last 5 or 6 years to see how virtual reality could be used as a way to help with both physical therapy and pain management, where it kind of distracts the person who is stuck sitting in a hospital bed and being just kind of generally miserable and gives them this kind of escape while dealing with other things. And the results have been pretty spectacular, especially when it comes to pain management, by being able to provide this kind of other environment for you to occupy your mind in. There have been some pretty significant reports in not feeling quite as much pain as you would if you were just kind of sitting there watching the television or reading a book or something, or just kind of being stuck there. There's just a lot going on in your brain when you're doing something in virtual reality. There's kind of this big conversation about whether virtual reality is safe for children.
Right.
Most virtual reality headsets have a 13 and up warning on the box. If you go into a store and you buy something, there's this thing on it that says, if you're over the age 13, it's not really recommended that you use this thing. This company called Starlight has been working with hospitals all over the country and with Lenovo, among other companies, to provide virtual reality headsets to hospitals specifically for children. And a lot of the children in the examples that they provide are, in fact, under the age of 13.
Mm-hmm.
So these are examples where, doctors have expressly permitted the use of these services to children under the age of 13 and have found a lot of the exact same results that they find in adults, that while it is carefully managed so that the kids are not spending too much time in the headset in order to cause potential eye problems, when they are in the headset, they experience dramatically less, pain reporting and are able to visualize themselves doing more and feeling more, generally upbeat at the same time.
And this is instead of or in addition to drugs?
It varies from patient to patient, but yes, the idea here is that this is not a total replacement for pain medicine, but it is documented here that significantly less pain medicine is needed.
How are physicians responding to this?
This has actually been a setup that has increased over the last 6 months. Starlight has increased its reach to many, many more hospitals and has not yet extended to any kind of general practice. This is something that's been monitored pretty heavily in hospitals with a fairly regimented, you know, guide for what is appropriate and how long someone can use it. You know, and obviously this is the same kind of equipment that you can buy and use at home. You know, so there's some independent management that can be done there as well. But for the most part, this is something that is has been seen as very positive in the hospital environment.
I was going to ask if it was the same exact equipment, because it seems like when you're talking about children, they're going to have the headsets are going to have to be different sizes, that kind of a thing. No.
Yeah. So, I mean, the headset that's used by Starlight is called the Lenovo Mirage Solo. It's a Google Daydream headset that you can actually buy at Best Buy right now. You can pick up and use that. It's using some custom software to go with it to you know, provide some education and things like that. But the way that it works and the store that's available and the apps that are available are all the same things that you can pick up and use at home.
And the apps that they're using in hospitals, are they just educational or are they adventure type things or what? Do you know?
It's a combination of adventure and entertainment. The entertainment is often exploration in nature, you know, kind of global studies almost, where you can use the Google Maps system to, you know, take, you know, fly across the world and see a particular place, or some very simple, you know, kind of education-focused games. But again, a lot of that content is available right now in the store.
Okay. T-Mobile is making a big investment in 5G. We've been talking about 5G earlier in the program. More mobile carriers are rolling out 5G, or they have plans to do so, and T-Mobile has big plans. What's such a big deal about T-Mobile?
Yeah, so T-Mobile has gotten a lot of media attention recently because it has been trying to merge with Sprint in order to form this this kind of larger network. And Sprint has some big kind of network advantages that would give T-Mobile the ability to really compete with Verizon and AT&T in a big way when it comes to 5G. Without that relationship being fully cemented, T-Mobile made this announcement that essentially said, we don't actually need Sprint in order to be a leader when it comes to 5G networks. We have this plan in order to roll out our own 5G network. And a big part of that is working with Samsung and OnePlus to make sure that there's hardware out there that works really well, and rolling out its 5G network to a bunch more cities over the next year in order to be just tremendously competitive. So it's by this time next year, you know, it looks like, you know, T-Mobile is actually going to be one of the leaders when it comes to, you know, 5G network offerings in the country.
Did you ever think you'd see the day?
I did. T-Mobile has a really interesting history when it comes to rolling out new networks. It was one of the companies that was first to claim that they had 4G networks and be able to kind of roll that out. It had kind of a rocky launch and caught a lot of negative feedback for its 4G launch. So it was kind of my suspicion that when it did the same thing for 5G, it was going to be able to stand up and go, we totally learned from our mistakes and we've done this thing this way. And because T-Mobile CEO John Legere is involved, there was a healthy amount of swear words to go along with it about
what he thinks about his competition.
Yeah. He's a character.
He's always trying to give you free stuff. What about the merger? I mean, is it necessary?
No, in the sense that having fewer wireless carriers across the U.S. is kind of bad for consumers in general. I don't feel like the merger is necessary, but it will definitely make this rollout a lot easier for T-Mobile.
Okay. So they don't need them, but it's going to make it easier.
It will absolutely make it easier and will cause there to be this kind of very definitive three-way tie, basically, between which carrier is going to be the quote-unquote best in most places.
Who are the winners, the carriers?
The carriers are definitely the winners in this place. It's definitely not going to be us.
Okay. Black Friday ads. I think you and I have talked and other people have said it should just be like Black November now.
Yeah, the first time I heard Black November earlier this month, I kind of wanted to throw a rock at the person who said it. But it's definitely turning out to be true. There have been Black Friday ads all over the television. Anyone who tried to watch the football games this past Sunday, pretty much every single commercial break had at least one Black Friday ad telling you how awesome those sales are going to be. And the more that I watched them, the more that I went and kind of looked up some of the things that were being promoted. And some of them are not super great. And it's going to require people who are interested in kind of getting a deal for Black Friday this year to kind of pay attention. One deal in particular that caught my eye was actually rolled out by Nintendo. The Nintendo Switch is going to be on sale for a pretty considerable discount, but it's actually not the new Nintendo Switch. It's actually the original Nintendo Switch that we thought Nintendo had sold out of a couple months ago, because you couldn't find them in stores anywhere. It turns out that those are actually going up for a Black Friday deal, and it's worth pointing out that those have a battery that's not super great compared to the newer versions. And you know, has some connectivity issues when it comes to the Joy-Con controllers that connect to the sides drifting. Nintendo hasn't really done anything to fix those issues with this version that it's selling. It's just selling them at a discount that seems like a really sweet deal, but it ends up kind of not being.
So do your homework. But in general, I mean, you can't just assume it's a deal just because they're telling you it's a deal. That's the, you know, the bottom line here.
Right. There's a lot of market trends, especially when it comes to, you know, Black Friday deals online. There's a really interesting service. It has a very silly name. It's called Camel. Which is the actual name of the service. And what it does is it tracks the price of things over time, among other things. But you can actually, you see something on Amazon that says that it's 60% off. You can actually look it up on this service, and it will show you the price over time. And especially this month, in a lot of cases, what you will find is during the course of this month, it's actually been slowly increasing in price, you know, by, you know, 20 cents one day, a dollar one day, something like that. It slowly increases in price so that when that 60% discount happens, it's actually pretty close to the price that it was at the beginning of the month.
And also what I see on the internet online is not necessarily what you're going to see as far as the prices.
That is very true.
Yeah.
Prices are going to fluctuate a lot, especially in places like Amazon. It's really kind of fascinating how often prices on Amazon fluctuate from minute to minute for certain products. And a lot of that is just, you know, kind of automated systems that work with Amazon to kind of tweak things to get people's attention. But you definitely have to. It's not as easy to find an actual deal, especially during the Black Friday time of year as it used to be. But they're very good at telling you that it's a deal. So it's something that, you know, if you are kind of a savvy shopper and you're interested in actually saving money, you're going to need to work a little harder this year to see, you know, what the deals actually are.
Do you think that they're doing themselves a disservice by approaching it this way? Or are you saying that there's enough people out there that are falling for it that it's obviously making, you know, expanding their profit margins?
Oh, no, this is absolutely working. There are very few people who actually stop and confirm that something is a deal before buying. Just seeing the kind of markdown code is unfortunately all that's necessary in a lot of places for selling someone. In particular, on the internet, you know, this does not just apply to Black Friday. There's a tremendous market on Facebook where, you know, you click on something that you're interested in, something shows up in a Facebook ad, and the entire webpage says, you know, that there's 70% off of this thing, and they only have three left.
Yeah.
And you kind of have to buy this thing right now, and there's a countdown on the site. You have to order it within the next, you know, 45 seconds, or else everything's going to catch fire. you know, there's just a lot that goes into kind of pressuring someone into making that decision right then and there, and it works. It works really well. That's why you see more and more of it. You know, so it's definitely not something that is going to go away.
What do you think are going to be the biggies this Black Friday, or whatever they call it, Cyber Monday, or whatever they're doing? What do you think is going to be some of the better deals?
I think there are going to be two things in particular that are going to stand out. We're going to see a pretty significant drop in 4K television because, you know, this is the time of year where we start to see hype for the next generation of televisions when it comes to January at the Consumer Electronics Show. So televisions are always kind of a big deal, but this year in particular, we've seen, you know, inexpensive 4K televisions have already started to be a thing, where we started to see these televisions for $300 and $400, and we're going to see a lot more of that for some of these higher-end televisions as we get there. The other thing to keep in mind is that next year, there's a big expectation for the next generation of game consoles, in particular the PlayStation 5 and whatever the next Xbox ends up being called. And typically in this product cycle, we usually see, you know, great big bundles for very little money for PlayStation 4 and Xbox One. You know, so you can expect those to be a pretty significant thing for retailers as well.
Russell Holly, thank you so much. I can't wait to start our Christmas or holiday shopping guide in a few weeks.
Yeah, it's going to be great.
Russell Holly, contributing editor at Android Central. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for joining us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.